I'm Oscar Tullis, and I am speaking to Mr. Ralph Schmeling here at his home.
I'm going to give you some of the old history of Brownsville here. Brownsville was quite a cosmopolitan town. I'm going to start out by talking about Milton Cross. He was a Negro. He had business establishments both in Brownsville and in Matamoras. He was quite a financier. I remember him coming every day to buy a newspaper. He was driven over here by his chauffeur in a Dodge automobile and stopped across the street from our bank, which was the State Bank and Trust Company, looked at a newspaper, folded it up, and immediately left. This went on for about 2 months. Finally, one day, he looked at the paper and came into the bank and talked to Mr. Asham, the president of the bank, and he said, "Mr. Asham, I would like to borrow $50,000 for about 90 days. Immediately, Mr. Asham wrote out a note for $50,000 and cross-signed it and said, "Put that on my account there." He already had about $100,000 on the account. And he says, "Wire the Hanover Bank in New York to buy me 4,000 shares of New York Central stock." Mr. Asham said, "Mr. Cross, you're liable to lose half of your money." He said, "Mr. Asham, send the telegram." The telegram was sent, and a couple of hours later, we got a reply that the stock had been bought at $18 a share. We started watching the market after that, and gradually this stock started going up. Finally, one day, it hit $32. On that day, Mr. Cross came in and said, "Wire the Hanover Bank to sell my New York Central stock." We sent the wire, and within a couple of hours, the same way, we had the notice, and Cross had made about $80,000 on the deal. He says, "Take that note of mine now and stamp it paid and run it against my account." Mr. Asham says, "We owe you a refund on the interest here." He says, "You don't owe me anything. You lent me the money for 90 days. The bank has made 90 days interest. I don't need that money anymore. I'm not using it for anything else." And that was that. Sometime later, I know that it was Armistice Day, the 11th day of November, and if I'm not mistaken, it was the year 1918, a year after the First World War had stopped. And we had a holiday that day at the bank, and I took my Haynes automobile out to take a ride. We had just dirt roads at the time. When I was on the highway going out on what is now Highway 77, I glanced over to my right, and I saw Mr. Cross standing there holding the collar of his coat up. It was a rather misty day, and it had started to rain, and he was out there with a flat tire on his Dodge automobile. I backed the car up and went over there, and Cross told me, "Here's this chauffeur of mine without a jet." So I went to my car and got my jack out and handed it to him, and I said, "Let us go home and we can drink some hot coffee." And Cross said, "No, I don't want to take you away from where you're going." I said, "I'm going no place. I'm just out for a ride." He says, "What I'd appreciate is if you take me to Judge Seabury's office. I have a date with him at 4 o'clock. So I drove him into town and brought him to Seabury's office. As he got out of the car, he showed me his watch. It was 4 o'clock straight up. This was on a Friday. On Sunday, when we sat down for dinner at my home, there was a knock at the door, and Mr. Cross's chauffeur was there, and he had a little box, and in this box were 12 dozen chicken tamales that Cross had sent me. Those are the best chicken tamales that I've ever eaten in my life. I'm going to take you back now to the year 1898, when the 9th Cavalry, which was colored, made up of Negroes. Of course, the officers were white, but all the soldiers were Negroes and were stationed here in Brownsville. And they left to participate in the Spanish-American War. They were going on horseback from here to Galveston, where they were going to take boats to go to Cuba from Galveston. The top sergeant was left behind. And as these troops went out Elizabeth Street, which was then unpaved, you could see the dust flying up. Finally, this top sergeant had been left behind to padlock all the buildings in Fort Brown. As he showed up, the rest of the troops were possibly a mile ahead of him. As he arrived at the corner of 12th and Elizabeth Streets, a delegation of Brownsville businessmen stopped him and made him a gift of a gold watch with his name engraved on it. I can still see him pulling out his handkerchief and taking the tears off of his eyes. He then spurred his horse and went on to join the rest of the troops. Some years after that, colored troops of the 25th Infantry were stationed here in Brownsville. These were the Negro troops that shot the town up on the 13th day of August 1906. In this shootout, why, one of the men in Brownsville here was killed, Frank Natus, who was the bartender, and Ignacio Dominguez, who was lieutenant of police, had his horse shot from under him and had his right arm badly mangled. Ignacio Dominguez, who was known here as Joe Dominguez, how he got that name of Joe, I don't know, but he told me personally that these Negro soldiers came over and looked at him where he was lying under his horse. He played dead there. And he says he doesn't know whether it was fear of being shot by these Negro soldiers or whether he realized that they were going back to Fort Brown and that the shooting was over, that he didn't pull his revolver and shoot at them. He could have easily killed two of them. He says he knows they'd have killed him. I think there were four or five in the group that came to see him. These Negroes had trouble here with certain people here in Brownsville. Fred Tate and Fred Stark were both customs men. They lived in adjoining houses that my grandmother, Mrs. Joanna Souter, rented to them. Fred Tate had struck one of these men over the head with his revolver and knocked him down, Tate claiming that this man and some other soldier had swept through these ladies that were coming out of the church that Sunday night, and they had it in for Fred Tate. One of these Negro soldiers on the day of the shooting took place about 11:30 at night, and this was in the late afternoon. He was asking the natives around here, he spoke Spanish, and he wanted to know where a customs man by the name of Federico lived. All these people around Brownsville here had known Fred Stark for over 30 years, and they pointed his house out. Fred Tate wasn't very well known here. He'd only been here about 90 days. When the shooting took place that night, the soldiers fired into Fred Stark's house. They had to shoot over a brick wall that was on the side of the house. That's what saved the Stark children from being killed. Bullets came within about 8 inches over their beds. I remember seeing splinters of wood in the mosquito bars that came from the walls of the house over the children. Sometime later, I'll say 10 years after that, in this raid here, none of these Negro soldiers was injured. There was a meeting, you know, of Senator Foraker of Ohio. There was a big Negro vote in the state of Ohio, and he took the place, the part of these Negroes. President Theodore Roosevelt had discharged the whole battalion out of the army when he sent an investigator down here, Major Bloxam, to investigate the shooting. And Major Bloxam, among other things, after making other investigations, went up into the attic of Pancho Ituria's house that adjoined Fort Brown across the street from it and looked through these bullet holes in the roof, and he could see that those bullets came from the porches of Barrack C across the way. He sent a wire to Theodore Roosevelt telling him that the Negro soldiers had shot the town up. It was then that Theodore Roosevelt sat down and in longhand discharged the whole battalion out of the army. None of them would give any testimony with reference to the thing. Well, Some 10 years later, the wife and I used to go to these dances at the Officers' Club in Fort Brown. And I don't know how this subject of the shooting up of Brownsville came about, but Captain Herr, who was the captain in the 4th Infantry, sat down next to me and said, "You know, the Negro soldiers never shot Brownsville up. The discipline in the Army is such that that never could have happened." At the very time that he was telling me that, Negroes, that is, Negroes of the 24th Infantry, were shooting Houston up. In this shootout, some 10 or 12 of these Negroes were shot and killed. They also killed several policemen and an Army officer. Among the people that these Negroes shot and killed was a section foreman of the Southern Pacific Railroad. His son, who was 12 years old, went home and got his father's shotgun and lay down on the embankment, and as these Negroes came back from the shootout, he shot and killed 3 of them. Later on, these Negroes were court-martialed and 26 of them were hung at Kelly Field in San Antonio. I am now going to tell you something about James B. Wells, who was the political boss of Texas. Mr. Wells was a very prominent man, very well up on everything. He controlled about 250,000 votes in the state of Texas. In other words, San Antonio was then the big town in Texas. He controlled the vote of San Antonio, Corpus Christi, Laredo, Brownsville, and Beeville, and territory in between there. If you were running for any state office, you always came to see Jim Wells to see if you had his support or not. Jim Wells was the lawyer that represented the King Ranch. He was supposed to have a retainer's fee in those years, way back then, of $50,000 a year. I worked in the State Bank and Trust Company. The State Bank and Trust Company, through evolution, has now become the First National Bank at Brownsville. The bank still exists. But the banking hours at that time were from 8:30 in the morning until 3:30 in the afternoon. One afternoon, about 4 o'clock, Mr. Wells showed up at the bank and knocked at the front door. I let him in, and he came over and talked to Mr. Asheim. He said, "Adolph, I want to draw on the Clayburgh Bank at Kingsville for $10,000. Tina, that was his wife, wants to take a trip to New York. I owe you people possibly $6,000 or $7,000 here, and if I'm not mistaken, my bank account, as usual, must be overdrawn." So Mr. Asheim went to the phone and came back within a couple of minutes and said, "Yes, they say they'll pay the draft." So we made out a draft on the Clayburgh Bank at Kingsville, and Mr. Wells signed it, and we credited it to his account. He then drew a check for $2,000 for Mrs. Wells to have money to take her trip to New York, and he told me, "Get all of my notes together, figure the interest on them, and charge them to my account just like checks." He was about to leave, and he came back, and he says, "Write me another check for $200. I did. He says, "Give me that in dimes. All the dimes that I gather, I put on my son Robert's savings account over at the Merchants National Bank." So I gave him $200 in dimes, and he left. That was that. Well, the next morning before we opened, about 8 o'clock in the morning, Mr. Wells showed up again and came in and said, "Adolph, I want you to phone the Clayburgh Bank. I want to draw on them for another $10,000. Mr. Asheim says, "They won't pay it." He says, "Well, you go back to the phone booth and see what they say." When Mr. Asheim went back, Wells came over to me and said, "Ralph, you know, I came to Brownsville here in the year 1878. To join the law firm of Stephen Powers. A couple of years later, Mr. Powers died, and the full responsibility of the law office fell upon my shoulders." He says, "You know how I throw money around and how I like people. I like to grab a person and shake them by the hand and pat them on the back." And he says, "Money means nothing to me. He says, if I had my life to leave over again, I don't want to change it a bit. I like it just the way it is. About that time, Mr. Asham came back, and Mr. Wells said, well, what did they say? Well, they say they'll pay it. So that was that. Some days later, this man whom I had known for many years, I don't know his name, but if he lived today, I could point him out right away. He followed Mr. Wells into the bank, spoke to him in Spanish, and said, Mr. Wells, I would like to borrow $25 from you. You know, my wife died last night, and I'm trying to raise $50 for the funeral. Mr. Wells came over to me and said, make me out a check for $100. I did. He turned around and handed the $100 to the man and said, now give your wife a nice burial. I asked Mr. Wells, don't you want to take a note from this man for the money? He said, no. This is a person that unsolicited has helped me out politically for over 30 years. I wouldn't dare think of taking a note from him. That was that. Some years later, there was a bond issue here in Brownsville, and I was talking to Henry Maltby. The Maltbys were known here as staunch Republicans. And of course, Wells was the leader of the Democrats in this whole state. Now, Henry Maltby's father owned a hardware store. This was in the year 1907, but this bond issue was on, and I asked Henry Maltby, are you voting for the bond issue? And he said, no, I'm against it. And I said, why are you against it? He says, because Mr. Wells is against it. Anyhow, this man, Samuel Brooks, was a contractor and builder here, and Mr. Maltby Sr. owned a hardware store, a very good hardware store. Mr. Brooks always bought materials from him, hardware and so on, and he owed $800. The panic of 1907 was on, and Mr. Maltby was unable to collect from Mr. Brooks. So finally, he went to see a lawyer here by the name of Parks, and Mr. Parks told Mr. Maltby, I'm glad you came because court is still in session. We'll bring a lawsuit against Mr. Brooks, and I know we can win because you have all your invoices and everything. So that seemed to satisfy old man Maltby. He came home and spoke to his son Jasper. Jasper was the deputy collector of customs here in Brownsville, had the patronage job through the Republican Party. And Jasper told his father, Papa, that doesn't mean that you're going to collect any money. It just means that you're going to get a judgment. You won't be able to collect anything. So Henry Maltby, who I was talking to about the bond issue, said that he went with his father up to see Jim Wells, of all people, to see what he could do about collecting this money. Mr. Wells had just rented a bunch of offices on Elizabeth Street in what is now the C.R. Anthony Building. It was about 7 o'clock in the morning, and Henry had told his father, there's no use for us to go at this early hour there. Mr. Wells won't be there. They arrived at this head office and were met by Harris St. Clair. He was Mr. Wells' stenographer and secretary. They were much surprised to find out that Mr. Wells was already in his office. He always came down very early in case he had any calls from these ranches up the country or from the King Ranch. So Harris St. Clair went and told Mr. Wells that Mr. Maltby wanted to see him. Mr. Maltby was in terrible shape. He was 80 years of age and had palsy and was shaking very badly. And they walked through all these offices over to Mr. Wells' office. And Mr. Maltby told him about his troubles with this $800 that he was trying to collect from Mr. Brooks. Mr. Wells said, all right, I'm taking your case under these two conditions. The first condition is that after you leave here, that you don't go and see any other lawyer. And the second condition is that being that I am your lawyer, that you're going to quit worrying about this thing because it's up to me to do the worrying. So he says, if that's satisfactory, we'll shake hands on it. And they shook hands. And Henry says he left with his father and came home. But that didn't satisfy his father at all. He was very nervous. He never took any rest or anything. When night came, he went to bed and he tossed around. And about 2 o'clock in the morning, he got up and made coffee. And then he couldn't drink the coffee. So Henry says he was able to hold his father till about 6:30 the next morning to go back to see Mr. Wells. In the meanwhile, Harry St. Clair explained later on to Henry Mollaby Jr. what had happened there. Mr. Wells found out that Mr. Brooks had his banking account with Pancho Ituria in the Ituria Bank, and he drew up garnishee proceedings against the account. When an account is garnisheed, you can't draw any money out of it until the case is settled in court. Mr. Wells then phoned to the sheriff, who was Carl Ryan, and of course within 4 or 5 minutes Mr. Ryan was in Mr. Wells' office, and he handed him the papers and said, you go over to Ituria's bank and hand these papers to Mr. Ituria or his clerks there the moment that they open the bank up, which of course Ryan did. So then about 8 o'clock, Pancho Ituria showed up in Wells' office and said, Mr. Wells, what do you mean by garnishing the accounts of my good customers in my bank? And Mr. Wells says, well, this good customer of yours owes this client of mine $800. And Ituria says, well, if I take $800 off of his account, he won't be able to pay me $300 that is due next week. And Jim Wells says, well, if he isn't able to do that, you can take this money out of my retainer's fees and pay it that way. And he says, what I want is to get this money for Mr. Mollaby. So they left, and the next person to show up there was Mr. Brooks. And he says, Mr. Wells, I don't want to be in any trouble here. And Mr. Wells told him, you won't be in any trouble at all. You go down to Mr. Ituria's bank and bring me 800 silver dollars and put them on this table here. Well, Mr. Ituria says, I can't draw any money off of this account. You can draw this money off. I'm going to phone Mr. Ituria. You go and do that. So Brooks left, and the next person to show up there was Brooks with Ignacio Garza, the father of these Garza boys. One of them is a federal judge here now. And they came with the $800 and put them on the table there. And Mr. Wells took a typewriter cover and put them over the money. So when Mr. Mollaby arrived the next morning with his son, all trembling and everything, and asked Mr. Wells, how are you going to collect this money for me? Wells says, I've quit bothering about that entirely. And Mollaby says, that's the trouble with you lawyers. You take a case and then you forget all about it. As he said that, Mr. Wells took the typewriter cover off of the money, and he says, Mr. Mollaby, there's your money. Henry says that his father almost fainted there. Then he asked Mr. Wells, he says, you know, I forgot to ask you what your fee is. And Wells put his hand to his forehead and said, you know, in all this excitement, I forgot that myself. And he picked the dollar off of one of the tops of the dollars there and put it in his vest pocket, and he says, now we have that settled. He says, I was really awful disappointed in you when you came in here all trembly and everything. Disappointed for two things. The first thing, you had shook hands with me and said you were going to let me worry about it. The second thing was your opinion of the great James B. Wells, a man supposed to be capable enough to turn heaven and earth around. So that was the end of that story there. Of Wells, instead of telling a Republican, why don't you go to some Republican lawyer to handle this while you're going ahead and handling it for Mr. Mollaby? My name is Ralph Schmeling. I was born here in Brownsville on December the 31st, 1892. My grandfather, Louis Souda, the natives here pronounced the word Souda. So I guess in the future I'll be talking about the Sudas. My grandfather and this man Fruhoff, you see these Fruhoff trucks and trailers, they were both wheelwrights, in Heidelberg, Germany, I'll say about the year 1847 or so. They both came over to Liverpool, England, to work for a wagon work there in Liverpool. There was lots of sea travel between Liverpool and Tampico, Mexico at the time, and they decided to come to Tampico. They were young men in their late 20s. So they came to Tampico, but Tampico was very quiet. So Matamoros, across the river here from Brownsville, was growing up at the time, and they decided to come to Matamoros. My grandfather says that the first time that he came to the banks of the river, the Rio Grande, to look over to the American side, that there were about six or seven of these Mexican jacales here, these mud huts with palm leaf roofs. And he says the people in Matamoros used to farm over here in the daytime, came over to plow the land and to plant crops, and always went back to Matamoros to sleep at night. In the year 1849, when Charles Stillman laid out a town site in Brownsville, my grandfather came and bought a lot from him and stayed here. Fruhoff moved on to Chicago and grew up there with the wagon business. In the year 1900, I was privileged to see my grandfather make a wheel, starting out with a hammer and chisel, chiseling out the spokes and the little hub of the wheel, and then this proposition that went around the spokes, which was the edge of the wheel. On that edge went another proposition that was made of iron. The local natives here could do all this woodwork perfectly, but the iron went on red hot. A spike had to be driven and brought around, and then another spike, and by that time the wood was burning. You had to dip that wheel then in a tub of water that was there, and when the wheel dried, then the painting of those marks on the spokes went on, and when that dried, then it was varnished. And a wheel like that, that's the year 1900, sold for $1.50. I have no idea what a wheel like that would cost today. Referring to my grandmother, of course, she came here and was married to my grandfather by Hiram Chamberlain. Hiram Chamberlain was the father of Henrietta King, who was married to Richard King, that owned the King Ranch. Hiram Chamberlain had established the First Presbyterian Church in Brownsville. When my grandmother married here, why, Henrietta Chamberlain, that was her name at the time, she sang at my grandmother's wedding. This uncle of mine, Oscar Souter, was in Kingsville many, many years later when they were inaugurating a new schoolhouse in Kingsville, and Mrs. King was present there. He was brought over and introduced to Mrs. King, and she remembered very clearly having sung at my grandmother's wedding. Talking about my grandmother and her sister, they came over on a boat from Liverpool, England. Mr. J.T. Canales, who is the lawyer that still lives here in Brownsville, but he's very old, up in his 90s, and he's very feeble. He's unable to navigate much anymore, but at the time that I'm talking about, which is back about the year 1905 or 6 or something like that, anyhow, he came here from Rio Grande City. He was a young lawyer and he wanted to meet people. My grandmother owned a millinery and dry goods store, and they had the habit, the people at that time, of sitting out in front of a place, and they sat out in front of the store till about 9 o'clock at night. It was then that Mr. Canales came up and introduced himself and was handed a chair, and he sat down. About that time, this gentleman came by and took his hat off and said good evening and walked on through the crowd there. And Canales asked my aunt, Mrs. Miller, "Do you know that man?" Canales had the lawyer's mind for asking questions. She said, "Yes." He said, "How long have you known him?" She says, "Oh, approximately 50 years. Where did you first meet him?" She said, "In Liverpool, England. He was on the same boat with us coming over to Tampico, Mexico on a boat. We were coming to Matamoros. My sister who is now Mrs. Souter, was coming to settle an estate of her previous husband who had died and was coming to see the Nielsen family in Matamoros. We noticed on this boat as we left Liverpool, we were possibly 3 weeks out, when we would hear somebody walking out on the deck and we would look out through a porthole and it would be Mr. Randall. And in the daytime, we'd see him going up and down the steps into the hold of the ship. He didn't seem to sleep anymore. We kept traveling along, and finally, as we were nearing Tampico, the captain of the boat was at the steering wheel, and he told one of the sailors, "You go and cut that rope on the jib sail up in front there." When he said that, Mr. Randall pulled his pistol out and told this sailor, "Don't you take another step or I'll shoot you." When Randall said that, the captain of the ship jumped overboard. He was never seen again. It seems that this ship had been heavily insured because it had been repainted and everything, and the captain had drilled holes in the bottom of the ship. Mr. Randall showed them how the ship was just about 8 or 10 inches out of the water. When they had left Liverpool, it was a good 12 feet out of the water. He discovered the captain boring holes in the bottom of the ship. He intended to wreck the ship on some shoals outside of Tampico. Mr. Randall brought the ship into harbor at Tampico safely. Some years later in my store, Arneel Randall, the granddaughter of George Randall, of this man that saved them, walked by the store, and my grandmother told Arneel Randall, "You know, if it wasn't for your grandfather, I wouldn't be here today." She didn't know why. It was years later when I corresponded with her when she lived out in California. She had married a man by the name of Key and lived out there, and I got into correspondence with her and wrote her all of this story. In the year 1915, bandits wrecked the night train coming into Brownsville. On this train, Dr. McLean, that was the state health officer, he was among the people that were killed. Quite a few other people were wounded. The train never arrived in Brownsville. It was derailed about 7 miles out of Brownsville. There was lots of trouble here with bandits at the time, and it so happened that lots of these natives that lived around here, many innocent people, were killed by rangers and others that were going through the country. I remember that there was a report of another raid on a train later on one Sunday night when a concert was going on in Fort Brown. It fell my lot to take a bunch of soldiers out there in my Haynes automobile, soldiers from the machine gun troop of the 26th Cavalry. And I took them out there, but we never found anything. As we were going through the brush, there was a Negro there that pointed a rifle at us and told us to halt. This was at a camp by an oil well that was being drilled there. But nothing really happened. There weren't any bandits or anything else. But quite a few people were being killed. At that time, A.Y. Baker was sheriff of Hidalgo County. And this man, who was of Mexican extraction, but he was ignorant, he couldn't read or write, he was very friendly with A.Y. Baker, the sheriff of Hidalgo County, and he came to Mr. Baker and asked him for a letter, if he could give him a letter as to his reputation and so on. And Baker says, "I'll be very glad to do it." So Baker gave him this letter. Of course, he couldn't read it, but sometime later, why, he decided to visit a brother of his over in Reynosa, Mexico. And when he came to the immigration offices at the bridge, they asked him if he had any documents proving his citizenship. He says, "No, but I have a letter here from A.Y. Baker, the sheriff of Hidalgo County." So they read the letter, and the letter said, "To whom it may concern, this person, Ramon Rodriguez, is a cattle thief and should be shot on sight." They read the letter, and they knew very well that if he had been a cattle thief, that Baker would have shot him, so that letter was just as good as any good letter of recommendation, and they said, sure, you can go to Mexico and come back any time you want with this letter. It's perfectly all right. This was some 25 years ago. I worked for the Public Health Service here. I was a quarantine officer, and I had to go to the Marine Hospital in Galveston for treatment there of a growth that I had here on my jaw. I had what they call a calculus stone, and I went there, and I was put in a room with a man by the name of Hooper. When he found out that I was from Brownsville, he wanted to know whether I knew A.Y. Baker. It just so happened that I knew A.Y. Baker quite prominently. He says, you know, A.Y. Baker was my cousin. At this time, Baker was already dead. He had died. But he says, my father owned a butcher shop, sold meat on the Courthouse Square in Batesville, Texas. He says, A.Y. Baker and all these Bates boys became Texas Rangers because the father of the Bates boys had been one of the original captains of the Texas Rangers. And through his influence, all these boys became Texas Rangers. He says Baker was always a boy that was large for his age. At this time that I'm talking about, when my father went to pay his taxes, he always waited till the 31st day of January, the last day he could pay taxes without paying interest or penalty. So he says, son, I'm going over to pay my taxes. You take charge of the shop here. He had no sooner left than Yancey, that was A.Y. Baker, showed up, and he says, say, I want some meat for my dogs. And I told him, you've got to wait till Dad comes back. He says, wait, hell, you're going to give me the meat right now. And he started in after me. He was raising this part of the counter that raised up and was coming after me, and I looked under the counter, and I saw a broken bottle there, and I picked it up and threw it at Baker and hit him in the side of the leg with it. I could see blood coming out, and I ran out of there, and Baker after me. I ran over to my grandmother's house because I knew Baker wouldn't follow me there. That was one person that he respected and was afraid to confront. Well, a couple of weeks later, I turned the corner in Batesville and ran smack into A.Y. Baker. He grabbed hold of me, and he says, don't you worry about what happened. That's all been settled. Evidently, the family had read the riot act to him. This man, Hooper, was a chef. He cooked in restaurants, and at one time, he had been a chef in the Harding Eating House in Harlingen. And every other Sunday afternoon, he had that time off. So he told his wife, I think tomorrow, which was going to be Sunday, we'll drive up to Hidalgo County and see what Yancey is doing up there. So sure enough, the next day they got into their automobile and drove up there. Baker lived in a home about half a mile from Edinburgh. As they were driving along, Hooper hadn't seen his cousin maybe in 20 years or so, but he saw him sitting on the front porch there in his shirt sleeves reading the newspaper. So he stopped the car and walked across the road, opened the gate, and walked over there. And Baker stood up and said, what do you want? And Hooper says, I'm looking for the sheriff. And Baker says, well, I'm the sheriff. And he says, I want to know if you have a scar on your left hip where this man Hooper threw a bottle at you some 20 years ago. Baker then recognized me and looked over and saw my wife sitting in the car. And he says, is that your wife there? And I said, yes. He says, bring her over here. And I asked Baker, do you think that it's safe? He says, shut your damn mouth up and bring her over here. In the year 1913, when the Carranza Army captured Matamoros from the federal troops there, the person here in Brownsville, Macedonio Garcia, had furnished most of the arms and ammunition to the Carrancistas to use in the battle there. Lucio Blanco was the commanding officer of the Carrancistas, and he had direct orders from Mr. Carranza in Mexico City that anything that Macedonio Garcia asked was to be obeyed, that while he was the commanding officer there, that Macedonio Garcia, that his word would have to be followed. I remember when Castro took charge in Cuba, how he started executing people. The same thing was going on in Matamoros at the time. And people came to Macedonio Garcia here in Brownsville. He had an establishment. He lived upstairs. He had a warehouse downstairs of a wholesale grocery house. And people started coming to him, wives and sweethearts and sisters of people that were going to be executed, coming to Macedonia to save them. And Macedonia started going and bringing people back from the jail in Matamoros. And it got to a point where so many people came that Macedonia's wife told him, you know, when your parents named you Macedonia, they made a mistake. They should have named you Salvador. Well, there were three Catholic priests that were in jail in Matamoros. One of them was from Linares. Another one was from San Fernando. And I forget where the third one was from. And the rumor spread that they were going to be executed the following morning. Macedonio Garcia was a peculiar person. He always gave you the contrary move on anything. In other words, he had a reputation for being strongly anti-Catholic here. He was always criticizing the Catholic people. He was a Presbyterian by religion, a member of the Mexican Presbyterian Church. When a new minister came here for the Mexican Presbyterian Church, a man by the name of Archimedes Martinez, whom I got to know pretty well, he came to me and he says, you know, I'm having trouble with Macedonio Garcia. He's very anti-Presbyterian. I told Archimedes Martinez, don't pay any attention to Macedonio Garcia. He's just trying to get a rise out of you to say what you're doing. You agree with him, what he says about the Presbyterians, and you won't have any trouble with him at all. Well, anyhow, these priests were in jail over there, and this Bishop Nussbaum, who was the bishop of the Diocese of Corpus Christi, which at that time included Brownsville, this is the year 1913, why, the Catholics were all upset about these priests going to be executed. So Bishop Nussbaum decided to come to Brownsville. What could he do? He could do no more than any of the other Catholics. But this particular night, about 2 o'clock in the morning, this Padre Francisco, one of the priests, came to see Macedonio and begged him to go to Matamoros to get the priests. Macedonio told him, don't you pay any attention. These are just rumors. They're not going to execute any priests. But Padre Francisco was insistent, so Macedonio went over there, took the risk of going at that hour of the night, and at 5 o'clock in the morning, he came back with the three priests. There were priests here in Brownsville from all over the valley, from San Benito, Hollingen, Mercedes, McAllen, Mission, and so forth, possibly 30 priests in all. Bishop Nussbaum arrived on the early morning train, and when he came over to the parish house, there were these Mexican priests. And when it was explained to him what had happened, he says, we all have to go over now and see Mr. Garcia to give him our thanks. So all the priests came over to see Macedonio, and they came in there. And Bishop Nussbaum told him, Mr. Garcia, I don't know how to thank you, but I want you to know this much, that anything that was in my power as the bishop of this diocese or any other way, all you have to do to have me do something is to command me and I'll do it. And Macedonia said, all right, like you have everybody taking their hats off when they come in front of your church here, in the future, I want all of your priests, when they come within my presence, to tip their hats to me. That was the situation when a couple of days later, I came over to Macedonia's place to collect a draft for him from the bank. And two priests, in a very friendly manner, walking across the street, tipped their hats to Macedonio Garcia. I had never seen that. And I asked Macedonio about it. He says, I thought you knew that I'm in charge of the Catholic Church. I give orders to the Pope, and if the orders come down from there, whatever I say, that is what is obeyed here.